on Saturday, and I haven't had a wristwatch for many years now. I don't know how many years. And I've noticed my relationship to time has changed a little bit now that it's always on my wrist, and I'm always looking at it. And in some ways, I feel more at ease with time that I have a watch. And sometimes I'm much more, in other ways, I'm much more conscious and more kind of caught by time, having it. So I want to talk about time, and time is one of the abstractions that we live in, one of the great abstractions. And like the air in which we walk through and live through, you can't really see time, but it's the context, the content of much of our reality. And even though the subject, in a sense, is abstract, in the sense that it's time, in some kind of way, doesn't really exist except as an abstraction of the human mind. The issue of time is very directly related to deep spiritual questions, deep spiritual realities. And most spiritual traditions that I know about will talk very seriously or investigate very seriously the nature of time. And I feel it's very directly related to our practice. And I feel that our practice, one way it has been put, that our practice, our mindfulness practice, can be understood as moving away from a life that harms oneself or others to a life of not harming self or others. And so much of the way we harm ourselves comes from our relationship to time, the way we relate to time, or the way we allow time to relate to us. Some people have coined the word time sickness, and time sickness is kind of a modern illness which gives people heart attacks and all kinds of horrible things happen to them. So I think it's very useful, very important to look at time because of the harm it does. And in the process of practice, part of the process of practice involves a radical transformation of our perspective or our relationship to reality. And it's a change of perspective, or it involves a kind of different perspective, or potentially involves a different perspective that has been called many things in many different religious traditions. But one of the things that's been called is the timeless. The timeless is one very important attribute or characteristic or name of a very important element of spiritual life. And there's a vital connection, I believe, between the mystery of time, and time I think is a mystery, and the mystery of awareness, or the mystery of spirituality. All these things are mysteries in a sense. In thinking about this today, I thought it occurred to me this expression in English, which I never really liked very much until today, said, time is of the essence. And that expression, in my mind, has kind of a materialistic or consumer or attitude towards time. And it's very closely related, in my mind, to the expression that time is money. But then I was thinking about that today, and what does it mean to say time is of the essence? What is the essence? And maybe time is of the essence of what's essentially important. Time is not a commodity, but it's still of the essence. And we have this expression, the moment of truth. Also very nice. The truth is always in the moment, in the now, the moment of truth. Where in time do we exist? Do we exist in the present? If so, then where and what is the present? You ever ask yourself, where is the present? Where does time come from? What is the source of time? Is the source of time outside of us or inside of us? I never thought of these things until today, but but I thought they were very interesting questions. Where is time? Is the present just the future rushing to become the past? What is the past? Have you ever thought about what the past is? The past is so important for many of us. And what is it? Or more important, where is the past? The past, all pasts, all end up in the same place. I think it was Jack this weekend or this last week, Jack Kornfield was talking about this, about how the yesterday's conversation is completely gone. Where is it? It's completely gone. It's in the past. World War II is in the past. It's completely gone. The Civil War is in the past. The signing of the Constitution is in the past, completely gone. Everything is in the same kind of place, kind of piled in there. It's all gone. Have you ever thought about where it all goes? You know, your personal history. Your fifth school, elementary school teacher. You know, what happened in fifth grade. It's gone the same place as the pharaohs went. I don't know if anybody has, maybe they have, or at least they could, write a book that was titled The Natural History of Time. And there's many books called The Natural History of Something or Other. Natural history, I think, of the concept of self, or the natural history of whatever. And part of what this title, Natural History, means in a sense, is that much of our human reality that we live in, these human concepts that we take for granted often, have a history to them. And they've changed over time. And they're conditioned by society and many, many different things. And we don't realize how much they've changed. Just, for example, the idea of the self that we think is absolute and we defend it, that our individuality, as if it was a religious absolute, is only, you know, I don't know, maybe it's only a few decades old. Maybe 100 years old or a couple of 100 years old. Time itself, for the way we most of us relate to time, is only a couple of 100 years old. Isn't that phenomenal? We think of time as being something absolute, at least I do sometimes. And the way we relate to time is relatively recent in the frame of time. In many traditional societies, work and leisure are integrated, are much more integrated in our own life. One of the great delights for me in my life has been living on farms, which I've done for some years. I lived on a farm in Norway for some time. And there was no difference between free time, leisure time, play time, and work time. It's an absolute way. They all kind of merged together, in and out of each other. When a lot of work had to be done, sometimes you worked 16, 17 hours when the hay had to come in. And then when the hay was in, we'd play for 16, 17 hours. Or we'd work in the morning for 4 hours, and then we would go for a walk. Or there was no kind of fixed time clock we had to relate to. And it was, to some degree, more or less, the mill workers in England during the 17th, mill owners in England in the 17th, 18th century who began defining what our relationship to time was, the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. That until the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, when they started having cotton mills, I guess, and spinning wheels, people just kind of spun and took care of and made goods at home. And then they started making these factories. And when people started working for the factories, the employers began, in some sense, being the owners of people's time. And maybe more importantly, the owners of their attention. That their attention had to be directed in a certain place. And they had to be at a certain place at a certain time. And your efficiency, what you did during that time, when you left, when you were free to have lunch, was all dictated and defined by the needs of the Industrial Revolution. And then with time, through time, this system that was started in England with the mills became worldwide. And very much the kind of time schedule of working from 9 to 5 that many of us have is a continuation of what began during the Industrial Revolution. The so-called secularization of our society, it's maybe been overworked to some degree, but there used to be, or still is, in many cultures and many religions, the idea of sacred time, which has very much been forgotten, I think. Sunday, still in some places, is sacred time. When I was working on this farm in Norway, we had to be kind of surreptitious about working on Sundays. Because the people in southern Norway were kind of fundamentalist Christians. And you absolutely didn't work on Sunday. It was an insult to God or whatever. And so we had to be kind of quiet if we were going to work. We weren't Christians, so we didn't kind of differentiate. But I wonder what we lose when we lose sacred time. I have a friend at Stanford who's a Seventh-day Adventist. And she, like all students, is always very busy running around. But Saturday is her sacred day, and she doesn't do anything on Saturday. And when I first heard about this, I was kind of shocked. How can you spend a whole day not doing anything? I mean, there's all these things that have to be done. And every day of the week, a sacred day. So instead of sacred time nowadays, many of us in America have sacred time or sacred days is we have recreational time or recreational days. And maybe there's a big difference between a day of recreation and a day of the sacred. And then also I think the advertising industry have become masters at capturing our time and our attention. And in order for us to become better consumers, which is very, very important, you know, we have to be convinced that not only do we need more things, but we need to do more things with those things. Our time needs to be more and more filled so we can consume more and more. And so we rush about. And it's amazing how much we rush about. The treadmill of time, the treadmill of rushing around between meetings and schedules and picking up the kids and after school and taking them to baseball games or whatever we have to do. And as we rush about, rushing ahead, our bodies begin to disintegrate or to become fragmented. And I think you probably, like me, you've read many of these accounts of, or heard about, or you are such a person, who have felt kind of that you, as you rush ahead, kind of filling your life with more and more, trying to catch up, that you've had some kind of physical breakdown. Maybe sometimes a heart attack. I've known people who have had premonitions that they better stop, and they haven't, and they've gotten heart attacks. In my way, I've gotten sick, just simply gotten horrible colds. And sometimes I felt a cold has been my body's kind of way of insisting that I slow down, that I stop, because I just can't continue living the way I'm living. And the kind of rushing, kind of filling time that occurs in our society brings with it kind of a constant whirlpool of chatter and judgment and denials, opinions, fears, and anxiety in the mind. We start living in mind time, in clock time, in society time. We find ourselves under tremendous time pressure. And then we're always seeking, many of us seek then better and better ways for time management. And as I said, time becomes a commodity. And I wondered about this, about how many of us, we measure our worth by how much money we make per hour. And that's what it's come to. Today I was at Stanford, up in the library. And I'm not registered as a student during the summer, but it's possible to have library privileges during the summer. But you have to go to the privilege desk to get privileges for the summer. Now, the privilege desk is one of my worst experiences at Stanford. I don't know what it is. Maybe because people always want something from the privileged person, and it's difficult for her. So here it was. And I was, you know, in a hurry. My time is very important. I had to get somewhere, right, and do things. And I had to prepare a talk this afternoon, you know, on time. And so I showed up and I showed my card to the guy who let you into the library. He says, uh-uh, you have to go over to the privilege office desk and get a sticker. So I looked over there, and there was this long line. So I got to the end of the line, and the first person was there forever, working out their bill over the books. And you know, and I was feeling somewhat intolerant. Don't these guys, people realize that my time is very important? And maybe, you know, this is to exaggerate a little bit, maybe, but, you know, why doesn't the world kind of shape itself to my will? And one of the great experiences is to go to a third world country where it's very clear that the world is not going to bend itself to your will. And it's not even going to bend itself to some absolute will. The absolute will of a, you know, a time schedule, which is, what is it, I don't know, God-given, or I don't know who decides time schedules. You know, that the bus has to arrive at a certain time and leave at a certain time, and the trains. And, you know, it doesn't make any sense in India to be intolerant. If anything, you're just grateful that it arrives. And maybe, you know, the fact that to some degree things work on a time schedule and we can somewhat reliable here in the West, maybe that's a disservice to us, because it kind of feeds into our need to always be rushing ahead and getting somewhere. So after a few moments, minutes of feeling my impatience, I stood in line and closed my eyes. And I could feel what my impatience had done to my body. I could feel the kind of energy kind of pounding kind of on the surface of my body. And it was great to feel, because as I felt it, I could feel kind of my body begin to coming together again from being fragmented. And I stood there until I noticed the person in front of me, that their feet shuffled forward. And then I opened my eyes. So we struggle to make time as if time could be made. And when we have time in our hands, we talk about killing time, as if empty time was an enemy. Isn't this an amazing expression, to kill time? My God. And what really happens when you reach the deadline? What an expression we have, the deadline. I was thinking today about it. What does it mean? And I was told that in Singapore, sometimes they have the alternative expression, dateline. And maybe we should think of some alternatives to deadline. And then if we're not rushing, sometimes we're not brushing ahead. And we have too much time on our hands. And we don't know what to do with ourselves. And, you know, time becomes oppressive because we have so much time. The deepest depression I ever entered was when I was about, I guess, 20 or 21. And I was unemployed, living in Berkeley, not knowing what I was supposed to do with my life. Not having a job, not being able to get a job. I had no skills worth anything. And I was completely depressed. The empty time was very difficult. And then we talk about lost time. Can you lose time? Where does it go? It goes where the past goes. Where does time, go anywhere? Time is always here. So how do we lose time? We can lose time in a sense by losing our connection with the present, by thinking or obsessing about the past or obsessing about the future. So then coping with stress is often a matter of taking time out. I think it's an interesting term, time out. But that's a very wise way of coping with a time stress, is taking time out. And I have here a list of 21 different ways to reduce stress during the workday. And I thought, just because I'll read some of them to you, because some of them relate to using time differently, taking time out. Take a few minutes in the morning to be quiet and meditate. Sit or lie down and be with yourself. gaze out the window, listen to the sounds of nature, or take a slow, quiet walk. While your car is warming up, take a minute to quietly pay attention to your breathing. Somewhat related, stay in the right lane and go 55 miles per hour. I noticed some, I started noticing this about maybe 3 years ago. I noticed that this person was driving extremely slow on the freeway. Like, maybe if a cop had been there, maybe they would have given them a ticket. But if we're going so slow, but going slow, slower than what they should have, because, you know, I'm going 65, and maybe they're going 50. I don't know what they were going. And suddenly I'm up against their tail, right? And, Jesus, how could they drive so slow? And I would pull around, and then I look at, who is that person? And after a while, I saw there was a pattern. And I don't know, this is just a pattern I saw. I don't want to generalize because maybe then it's dangerous. But I noticed in the last 2 or 3 years that every time that situation has occurred, and I've seen that a car is driving particularly slow on the freeway, it's usually an older car, maybe just a car. The old car can't get any faster. But it seems always to be someone, an Hispanic person, a Mexican-American or Chicano or something. So I don't know, I don't want to generalize exactly, except at some point I noticed the pattern of my observations. And then I thought, oh, there are other cultures that have different attitudes about time. And they're just living in a slower time. They're not rushing around. And that's just as valid as my way of living. And here I am, here was on the freeway, was this confrontation of two different times, ways of living. And when I realized that, from then on, I've always been extremely, not only forgiving, but appreciative of those cars when I come across them on the freeway. It's kind of a reminder to me of another possibility. And it's interesting to study, kind of anthropologically, all the different ways that people in different cultures relate to time, and realize we don't have to relate in the way our society tells us to. How about siesta at 12 o'clock? I remember growing up in Italy, the difficulty, the kind of infuriation at 1:30, everything being closed. I mean, what do they think we're supposed to do? Go all the way home and then come back? After parking your car at your workplace, take a moment to orient yourself to your work day. Use your breaks to relax rather than simply pause. For example, instead of having coffee and a cigarette, take a 2 to 5 minute walk or sit at your desk and recoup. Decide to stop for 1 to 3 minutes every hour during the workday. Become aware of your breathing and bodily sensations. Choose to eat 1 or 2 lunches per week in silence. Use it as a time to eat slowly and to be with yourself. Coping with time, with stress, time stress. One of the interesting things you can do with time stress is when you find yourself stressed around time, is rather than trying to rush and do more, is to come to a complete stop. And this you should try. And see what happens. Where does time go? Does it disappear? You're always in the time. You're always in the timeless moment of the present. I find for myself that the world seems to take care of itself quite well without my interference. And more often than not, it's quite fine for me to stop. And probably often I feel like I'm actually more efficient if I stop. When the Chinese translated the two words for meditation, mindfulness and concentration, into Chinese language, they translated mindfulness, concentration with the character to stop, and mindfulness to look. So if you find yourself stressed with time, use that as a signal to stop and look. Stop and pay attention. Stop and appreciate what you can't appreciate because you're rushing around. Another way of coping with time stress is to sit every day. And maybe this is difficult for some people, but there's a tremendously profound effect that sometimes isn't clear until you've done it for a few months, of sitting every day. And there's a way, kind of sitting every day lubricates your day. It's the lubricant of time. And you'll find your time, you have lots of time, much more time, You have a much more calm attitude towards time if you sit every day. Another way of coping is to simplify your life. Read less newspapers, for example. Watch less television. At some point I realized that after a week, I remember almost nothing that I remember that I read in the newspaper. A few highlights. And when I realized that, I said, well, why am I reading it? And since then, I've been much more judicious about choosing what I read in the paper. And so I read what I think I might remember, what's useful. And then I have much more time. There's many ways of simplifying your life. And related to this is the question of what do you think is the most important thing in your life? And I think for some of us who are meditators, I think the idea of being aware or being of presencing our life, being in the now, being open and sensitive, has very high value. But it's this nebulous, ephemeral thing. Awareness is almost as ephemeral, abstract, maybe as time is. And it's so easy, because we can't see it directly, we can't relate to it so directly, immediately, we tend so easily to get caught by other things which seem much more important. And are they really that important? And why do we keep forgetting about maybe what is the deepest, has the deepest importance for us? And our priorities get a little bit skewed at times. And sometimes it's valuable just to renew or reconnect with your deepest intention. And you might, if you do that, find yourself living in time rather than living, being controlled by time. And then a fourth way, which someone has suggested about coping with time, which I thought kind of curious, is the idea that you can exchange money for time. Some of us don't have much money, so maybe it's not an issue. But some of us have some money. We've saved up some money. Maybe some of us are maybe well-to-do or middle class or whatever. And we're still rushing around. What about either making less money so you have more time or exchanging your time for money? I don't know exactly what that can mean. I mean, it can be in some horrible consumer way so that you just keep making yourself busier and busier. But how about using some money or the lack of money to give yourself more spacious time, more free time? So what is time and what is the present? I find it curious that in Buddhist psychology, they differentiate between different kinds of time, different kinds of present moment. And one of the times, two kinds of times, is mind time and body time. And one of the interesting thing about the difference is that then they say they've measured, I don't know how they've measured this, and they've said that the body is 1/16, goes at 1/16 the speed of the mind. Sometimes I feel in my life that this mind probably goes at 100 times the speed of the body. And that's when we start becoming fragmented. We lose touch with our body. There's such a thing as body time. Sometimes I talk to myself about breath time. And if you connect to your breath time or your body time, the rhythm of your breath, the rhythm of your body, you find yourself living in a much more harmonious body and mind, much more harmonious world than if you're only living in mind time. Also, it's interesting that Buddhism distinguishes between different kinds of present time, so different kinds of present moments, or the present. On one hand, there's the momentary present, which in some sense maybe is frozen time, just the very brief moments of time that are very discrete in and of themselves, and momentary events that sometimes in very strong states of meditation you can be aware of, kind of these frozen moments of time. But the kind of mindfulness, the other form of time, of the present moment, is what's been translated into English as serial time. And this is what's understood as the now. So momentary present is the frozen time, and the serial present is the now. And the serial present includes a spectrum of many of these momentary present moments. in one Buddhist, ancient Buddhist text, it defines the serial present as being the amount of time it takes for you to, if you're outside in a bright sunny day and you walk into a dark room, the amount of time it takes for your eyes to adjust, that's the now. So that's the serial present. Or I think William James talked about the saddleback of the present. And the saddleback of the present isn't this particular single moment, but it is a single kind of the present which includes part of the past and the future. It's kind of continuity of time over some kind of length of time. Maybe it's very, very short. Maybe it's shorter than the time it takes for the eyes to adjust. But but in talking about serial time, the Buddhist tradition wants to say that this, that the time, or the serial time, or the serial present, the now, the nowness that we can experience, is an experience of open time. That it's not a discrete thing in and of itself, but it's open to the past and the future. That it's connected to the past and the future. That it includes the past and the future. Nowness has no rigid boundaries. The future very much depends on the present. There can be no future without the present. And in some ways, what we do in the present defines the future. It's a beautiful title to one of Thich Nhat Hanh's books, for a future to be possible. It's the way we live our life makes a future possible, perhaps. The open serial present, the open now, is what connects us to rhythms. Our own rhythms, our own physical and life rhythms, and to the rhythms of music, rhythms of a ritual, the rhythms of nature. And rhythm is defined by what is past and what is anticipated to come. It's defined by what comes before and what comes after. And rhythm is a really beautiful thing. It's part of the joys of life, is to be connected to rhythm, to dance in rhythm. Most cultures have had music with rhythm. And if you're very strictly, frozenly in the present moment, you have no connection to rhythm. Because rhythm requires you to have an open sense of time, to be open to some sense to the past and the future. Then there's the expression or the idea of a depth of time, or that time has depth to it also. For many of us, we live in chronological time, which for us is a linear time. It kind of goes linearly from the past to the present to the future, and just it's going very nicely and kind of chugging along. And it's a linear horizontal vision of time. There's also the depth of time, deep time, and this is what's connected to what in Buddhism is called the timeless present, the now. And there are things which gives the present depth. And it's possible to be aware of the depth of time. A couple of these things. One aspect that gives time depth is this thing about the past and the future. Both act on the present. Both are involved in the present. I mentioned before rhythm. There's also traditions and ideals survive from the past. And a very important part of our life, in some sense. An Indian, American Indian teacher who I spent a little bit of time with, said that our personal history was the heartwood of our tree. And I like that very much, because the heartwood is dead of a tree. But it's essential, the heartwood is essential to hold up the tree. So I think that's an interesting idea. So our personal history is the heartwood of our life. Also, there's depth in time because the present moment, the present time, contains within it a tremendous amount of potency and potential. The present situation is pregnant with possibilities. And if we allow ourselves to be open or to be sensitive to all the possibilities that can open up from the present moment, we'll live in a very, very deep life, very deep time. And it's very difficult if we're constantly rushing to catch up and rushing to make up meetings and get to meetings and whatever. I think it's very difficult to be open to the pregnancy of the moment, to what might happen. It happened so many times to me that I've given up my own agenda of what had to happen. And I take a moment just to kind of see what's happening in the situation and find that I connect with another person in the line I'm standing with and become friends, or we kind of have a very nice conversation and it becomes significant for me somehow. Or I notice something that I wouldn't notice if I'm rushing ahead. The present moment is pregnant with time, pregnant with possibility. There's also the idea of the quality of time. Because in the chronological approach to time, linear approach to time that we have, we're mostly concerned with the quantity of time, how much time we have, and can we get more time? And we lose touch with the idea of the quality. What's the quality of our time? What's the quality of our awareness? One of the things we're, maybe I should apologize for using the word, protecting in mindfulness practice is the quality of our awareness, the quality of our mind and our heart. So, quantitative time, chronological time, is horizontal time. And depth time is sometimes called vertical time. And they both exist together, but we lose touch with vertical time, the depth of time. Linear time is economic. Vertical time is body time, inner time. It includes the width and breadth of now, the nowness. Vertical time is found in part by listening to our body. And in this, I was thinking about this thing about the Industrial Revolution's contribution to our concept of time. I wonder, maybe some of you have studied this more than I, but I wonder how much the Industrial Revolution's idea of fixed work time from 9 to 5 was also then gave us school time. And that we kind of put kids into schools and they have to kind of work in this fixed time and they have to, you know, be certain places at certain times and not move certain times. And maybe it's necessary for efficiency's sake in our society to regimate kids to kind of school time. But in the process of that and other things, children lose touch with their bodies. They don't listen to their bodies so much. And we grew up not listening to our bodies. And one way of finding depth time, quality time, is to listen to body time, to our body. So the Buddhism talks about the timeless. It's interesting, Buddhism doesn't talk about the eternal. And I'm not sure what to make of the difference, but I think something for something to be eternal, it has to exist. And nothing exists in Buddhism. Or everything that exists is impermanent. It's radically impermanent in flux. So if you can point to something existing, it's in flux. It's changing all the time. So you can't talk about the eternal, but you can talk about the timeless, and that is that which is without time. So maybe it's a paradox, or maybe it's confusing to talk about that which is not time, when I'm saying that nothing. But maybe what's without time is not a thing. It's not a state of mind, even. And maybe the kind of insistence we hear sometimes in spiritual traditions that we should be in the present maybe is not such a good instruction, because strictly, except in the serial idea of the present, you can't really be in the present. As soon as you grab the present moment, it's already in the past. The present can't be really be held onto. But so rather than talking about being in the present, I like the expression of presencing our experience, presencing our life, giving offering presence to our daily time, to our daily experiences. We can presence our life. So our life is in living time rather than dead time. And if we really allow ourselves to fully be in the present, or fully be in now, I like the word now, or nowness, because that has this open feeling to it. Maybe because it's an ambiguous word. I think nowness dissolves time. And it's possible for time to disappear sometimes when we're in very much in the present moment, when we're presencing fully what we're doing. Some people have pointed out that the timeless in Buddhism is that experience which comes when we cease to identify with any of the objects of consciousness. When there's no identity, our consciousness doesn't get hung anywhere, then there's no measure of time. Time is an abstraction that it only exists because of change. Because there are changing events is what gives us the sense of time. And if we're not relating in a strong way, identifying very strongly with any particular event, any particular thing, time begins to lose its solidity or its hardness or its fixedness. Experience of timelessness. It's almost as if awareness itself is very closely akin to timelessness. All these things happen in the field of awareness, all this change, but awareness is always peaceful, always calm, never judging our experience, non-judgmental. Awareness doesn't have opinions about what's happening. Awareness is very closely connected to the sense of timelessness of the now. And timelessness has to do with the depth of time. There are many kinds of timelessness, I think. Maybe I won't go into different kinds. One kind you hear sometimes in Buddhism is a kind of timelessness that comes from a kind of radical time out. You completely step outside of time and space. And then there's another kind of timelessness which is defined by time. And time, in a sense, and change, reveals the timeless. The more we're in touch with impermanence and the changing events, allowing ourselves to flow with time, being in the flow is to be in correct time. The more we allow ourselves to flow, be with the flow or be fully with the change, we can also have a sense of the timeless, of time standing still. And there's all these wonderful paradoxes of language then. It's possible to say, oh, yesterday at 4 o'clock, I experienced the timeless. So the idea somehow is that truth and presence is outside of time. But we are still part of time. Someone can spend their whole life connected to the timeless as they age, get older and older, and then die. But a sense of the timeless, if you really feel the timeless of the present, I think you would not fear death. There'd be no reason to fear death. It's part of the value of learning about the timeless. And sometimes in the Buddhist tradition, the timeless is also called, the synonym for the timeless is the deathless. And then I'll end almost over. If any of you are getting impatient with the time and feel that we're supposed to end at a certain time, some of you do. And I've gone 2 minutes over. And the timeless is one of the epitaphs of the Dharma. What's called the Dharma in Buddhism, or the truth, or reality as it is, or the teachings. Dharma means many things, but it's one of the ways of referring to the Dharma. And there's a quote from the early Buddhist tradition. Well proclaimed is the Buddha's Dharma. It is immediately effective. It is timeless, inviting investigation, revealing, discernible to the wise, each one for oneself. That's a very kind of interesting combination of things. It's immediately effective, the Dharma, reality or whatever, the Dharma that we connect to, the ultimate reality. It's immediately effective. A moment of a mindfulness is immediately effective. It's timeless. A moment of mindfulness is timeless in a sense. A moment of mindfulness invites investigation. We want to kind of enter into more fully what is the experience we're in. And it's an experience that each one has for oneself. So I wanted to give this talk on time because I think it's a very important element to our reality. And as mindfulness students, we're mostly paying attention to what presents itself to us, to what is the given experience in any one moment. And since time, you can't really see time that clearly. Very few of us are noting in our mental notes or in our observation, oh, there's an experience of time. Oh, time, time. But time shapes our reality and shapes our life to such a powerful extent. I think it's very important to reflect a little bit about time and see what our relationship is to time. So that's why I gave this talk and why maybe it was kind of...
And he asked me to come. He's been encouraging me to talk more and more. And so this is my first official, I think, Dharma talk. Be it what it is. So what I wanted to talk about is what I do and know most. Thought it'd be a good place to start. And that's integrative practice. Integrative practice. And I don't know how many of you have sat retreats. I know many of you have because I recognize a number of faces. But we're working more on not just the sitting, not just the walking, but connecting all the pieces so that we can connect more and more our lives, our daily activities, reaching for doorknobs, washing dishes, brushing teeth, whatever it is. And so as kitchen teacher, that's what I do in the kitchen, training yogis, which are the students, to do whatever that work period that they have, we call work meditation, for 30, 40 minutes of the retreat every day. There's just one integrative practice, one work meditation that you stay with each day. And that's to help you work in a daily way on the more maybe gross or outward movements that we have. And to pull the pieces in that way, when we're working with sitting meditation and somewhat walking. Walking is a little more outer. But when you're working with sitting, there's very subtle things that you notice. And when you're doing the outward practice of working meditation, there's a lot more senses that we're connecting with and working with. So integrative practice has a lot to do with, has all to do with working with the six sense doors. I don't know how familiar you are with the six sense doors. Vipassana, we work with six sense doors. There's five, which are the senses that you're quite familiar with, of sight and sound and taste and touch and
smell.
Those are the five. And then there's the sixth one, which is the mental factors that we work with, of thinking and cognitive perceptions, things like that. And so we work with those in an outer way with work meditation. And it's for me, it feels like an easier way in a lot of ways. The blame and the judgment that we might have with our sitting practice, sometimes we can let go of in that grosser way. It's a little more humorous at times, and sometimes it's just easier to see it when we're out there, when we're clinging to a pot handle or a broomstick. You know, sometimes okay. So when you're moving really tightly with the broom, you get dust that flings off or doesn't move anywhere. And when you are too loose, you may drop your broom, or the dust will go off in a direction that you're not quite wanting it to or intending it to. But when there's just the right feel there, then you're working with the direction that you're intending. And that's to me, working with the hands is a great way to do this. I think of the practice, and I mentioned this, I think, last year at Jikoji when I spoke just a little bit, of the two wings of the bird, of compassion and wisdom. And for me, the arms are the extension of the heart, and the compassion and the wisdom. And so in washing dishes and in sweeping and whatever you do, you're right there seeing and moving and working with. So it's often more tangible in the practice. Everything is integrative practice. All of life is integrative practice. I know. Working with the sense doors, the sight, there's the three parts of sight. There's the actual physical eyeball itself. You can notice where it is in your face, how it moves, the little tendons and everything like that. You can just feel that. And then there's the object outside, which is the form, and it takes a form and color, or colors. And then there's the in-between. There's the perception, there's the cognition, there's the knowing that you're seeing, and there's knowing that you've been seen. There's just those three parts. But without the connection, without the interconnectedness, it wouldn't make sense. Same is true of sound, that you have the inner mechanism and you have the actual sound that you hear. Then you have the cognition, bird. Or you might even have, joy with the sound or some other thing with that. So using that, you have the sound, you have the mental factors of acknowledging that it's a particular sound, bird. You might even have the mental factor of relating it to joy. And joy, then you might experience in your physical body as a sensation, the sense of joy. This is the feeling of joy. And there in that is the wisdom. It's your understanding. Joy. Your understanding, sight, or sound. The same is true with each one of the five. The sixth piece, the mental factor, works with them together, pulls them together as a unit. There's some wisdom with the sixth. Oftentimes in Vipassana, we focus a lot on the mind, on the mental. Some because we have so much going on in this life that we have, all these thoughts running around. got a madhouse going on. But when there's wisdom with it, there's not the blame or the judgment of it. It's just, oh, this is what it is. And with that, or perhaps before it, depending on how we each work, is compassion. The compassion of with sometimes when I'm harsh with myself and I notice that I'm judging, then there is the judgment. And then when I accept the judgment, my heart can open and there's the compassion. So that's, in that way, there's the wisdom and then there's the compassion. But it also can come that the compassion is first. With joy, for me, it often there's compassion. So they all fit together. I started 17, 18 years ago. It wasn't quite 18 years, but I started many years ago with Ruth Dennison. And Ruth works with the Sixth Sense doors a lot. I don't know, some of you may know her, but she's quite a character. And tend to really either love her or you just, it's just too much. You just can't stand, you know, to be with her. And she just really wants you to wake up. You know, she's so intent on having us all wake up, you know, be Buddhas, that the tasting of a meal, our lunch meal, we're not left alone. She's there guiding us in the taste and helping us to know that we are tasting, and that there is the movement of the tongue and the teeth and the jaw and the whole range, the swallowing. That there is the grasping or the pushing away or whatever it is going on with all of those things. So I began early on getting this sense. This was my introduction to Vipassana. I went away to school for 5 years and did a holistic health practice. And in that, I had three areas: nutrition, movement, and counseling. And in the nutrition, we worked with all the sense doors. We didn't mostly focus on taste, but it was definitely included in there. And in the movement, I called it movement meditation. It was called movement psychology. But we worked with the three body centers of the head, the heart, and the belly. And in the counseling, it's a body-centered counseling. So we also used all the sense doors. So I continued to incorporate Vipassana in my education, in my training. And then came back out into Vipassana after school and got back into the kitchen. It seems to be the heart of my practice, working with the food and working with the people in the environment of the food. It seems to be my main avenue and my most comfortable avenue of practice of life is through that avenue of food. And it's kind of, it's not just the belly, but it works with the heart and the belly predominantly, and it goes through your whole being. So there's all of the six sense doors awakened up again in an immediate way. In the actual tasting, and then throughout of experiencing and coming to know coming to understand what a particular food does in this body, what a particular food does in another body. Kind of mixed those pieces up a little bit, but mostly I just want to say that integrative practice and the sixth sense doors are basically one and the same, and are basically the practice of Vipassana. And found that for me, without my work meditation, without my integrative practice, Vipassana wouldn't be the same for me. I wouldn't be well-rounded. The experience from Vipassana that we get of sitting and walking, for me, isn't the key. Isn't the main heart of the practice. For me, the actual physical being in the kitchen or wherever I am helps pull all the pieces together, and that it enlivens my practice, enlivens my life. And we're beginning in Vipassana more and more to include more work meditation, more integrative practice, the beginning of retreats, the end of retreats, and hopefully throughout more and more. And Gil has a strong Zen background, so he has probably talked to you about him being a Tenzo in a kitchen and the importance of that. And I too feel that same importance of practice. So hopefully in some way that you can bring this into your lives more and more. Maybe that's something that we can talk about with the last, 15, 20 minutes that we have, how we have incorporated integrative practice, and you can ask me any questions or...
deciding whether I'm doing a good job or a bad job, handle that.
Mm-hmm.
With integrative practice, and makes things harder for other people, really helps it in the world, so that the mistake you make, karma attached in sitting practice. Right. For me, it's a lot harder to be cool about mistakes.
Okay.
And in the kitchen, there's the mistake of thinking, what am I supposed to be doing? And with a lot of concern on my part, is am I doing it right? It's a tremendously.
Okay. Great, thanks. So for you, it sounds like it's more difficult for you to do integrative practice than sitting practice because of the factors of other people being involved. That isn't true for me, but I can see how that can be, and it has been in some situations. Now, for me, the hardest thing I'm doing right now. For me, talking in a group is the most difficult thing I could imagine doing.
So,
thanks. So, and it does affect many people. It does, and in some ways, it has kept me from talking. Because I think, oh no, I'm going to say something wrong, or what are they going to think of me, or it may affect their lives in some way. But the same which is true with yourself. When I'm sitting, I can harm myself. And I would have to go to a lot of effort to harm somebody else in just sitting here. But, some people on retreats, oftentimes we're very sensitive, and somebody's cough or somebody's rustling of their coat or if they have to leave early or whatever, we can get in quite a state about what someone else out here is doing, even though, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be. So the same is true with this, is how I react or how you may react to what I'm doing doesn't have to be harmful. I mean, maybe, you know, if you hit or, you know, if you did something really with intention to harm or unconsciousness, yeah. But we each have responsibility, and so, and we're each learning how to talk and how to move. So for you, what you might begin with is an integrative practice for yourself that works with you by yourself. You and the doorknobs, you and the broomstick, you and the dishes, and see where you are with that, you know. And then go to a situation where you're comfortable with someone and do that. And it is possible on retreats to do integrative practice with objects. You don't have to work just with other people, but you can too. Does that? Okay.
Uh-huh. You mentioned, and I very much explore the other end of that is being a retreat. The kitchen teacher of it that way, so that's what it was.
Uh-huh, yeah. Well, someone mentioned Gil teaching a class on metta. And so it actually is a metta practice, which isn't Vipassana, but they go side by side. They go along with each other. And compassion is a part of Vipassana, seeing clearly, you know, experiencing. So different things at different times. Sometimes when I'm chopping the vegetables, I'm just noting the beauty of the vegetables themselves. So there's sight involved. You know, I'm just noticing the beauty of an orange carrot or the heart of a cabbage. So it's very simple sight. Sometimes I'm thinking about, this is the beginning of the retreat. So the beginning of the retreat, I have a particular kind of meal that I do. And that's to help bring everybody in together to know, oh, they're here. This is a grounding. This is a centering. This is to help them know, oh good, they're safe. They can trust that the food's going to be okay. This is it. Okay. So a kind of a larger and more cognitive picture. And then I do taste the food as I work. Usually just a few times. But I get a sense. And I use intuition also. Intuition, I'm not sure where that one would be in the six senses. Sort of a seventh sense. I don't know. I have to work with that one. That one I work with all of the time, so I'm curious to see where it comes in. But it's definitely, I feel it definitely connected with the heart. And I just listen to voices that say, oh, put a little of this in or do a little of that. So it's using everything that's available to me and respecting everything that's available to me. It's that. And with the heart, the hands in my, I learned in the body movement classes of the three centers, and you know the head center being the one, and you know the crown chakra also being involved with that, and the heart, the arms and the hands are extension of the heart, the movement is so related there, and. When you're chopping vegetables or stirring soup, you're using your hand, and so you're using your whole body really, because this this center connects up the other two sensors.
Lots of food voices.
Lots of food voices.
Or some. I'm not meaning that.
I don't know how to say it, but yeah, there's communication that's pretty steady.
Around different kinds of food.
With the different fields of food, the different ethnic foods too, foods from different cultures, foods. I also work on with a cancer program, and so working with and Belina's at Commonweal, and so I work with 8 participants and then the staff, also all at the same time, and seeing who can eat what foods and what it relates to in terms of the dis-ease, as well as state of mind. If they need a little more joy in their life, or if they need a little more security in their life, give them foods that they, I mean, in talking with them, I know, that soup or that whatever, bread, or something that they can relate to. So using that. On retreats, we can't always... we get a lot of notes. We get a lot of notes in the kitchen. And so we can't always, be swayed by those by those notes. Because oftentimes, it's just greed or aversion talking. And so we note this too, as staff. We get to, whoa, we're having a rough day today. but so...
Garbage?
And rotten food. Well, it's a practice. Garbage is a little easier for me than food that goes to waste. But garbage, we're feeding the dumps, and we're feeding the earth, I think, in many ways. Now, some retreats we have compost that goes to animals, so they're getting their nourishment. So I know it's whenever we throw food away or whenever there's waste, that it's the food actually is the best thing to help all that plastic and paper decompose.
And part of kitchen is dirty food has with fat on it or that has stuck to pee, and there's a lot of dirtiness involved in cleaning.
Like cleaning counters and pots and not quite sure. Not quite sure. Can you say more? I'm not quite sure what you're meaning.
Okay. When the food is being given out, mm-hmm. it's all kind of fresh and new.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the dishes come back, they have old food, and of course, rinsing, you have water that pretty soon gets pretty awful. And things are kind of stacked up. Everything is where it doesn't belong. It belongs where it is right now, but you're going to have to change it. And I guess this feeling that this isn't right, I have to change it, I have to... That's one feeling.
Great.
That's uncomfortable to have.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second one is that it's hard to scour things.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. So you mentioned one of, that this is difficult for you. One thing is just to notice that there's discomfort, that it is difficult for you. Whether it's the sight that's unpleasing or, the actual physical scrubbing that's not pleasant, because all of life isn't pleasant. And so there is discomfort and there is lack of order or another kind of order. And so to be present with that, notice how you feel with it.
I was wanting another model.
You don't like yours, huh? Okay. well, I actually like it. I enjoy cleaning. See, I was not brought up, but in essence brought up by my Irish grandmother, who taught me the art and love of cooking. And she taught me every part, the cleaning, the shopping, the gardening, the canning, the whole bit, and everything she enjoyed. Any time, on the way into the kitchen, on the way out of the kitchen, resting afterwards, after doing all of the work, fully enjoyed. And so I got that training from early on. So one thing is no better or no worse than another. There are some things that sometimes that I enjoy more than other times, but I enjoy scrubbing pots. I mean, this year, hopefully, I'll get in the second half of the 3-month course, and I'm going to sign up for pot washing. I do not want to cook when I'm there. You know, I don't want to have to do that part. I get enough training on the job. One thing with pot washing, in experiencing from training pot washers, is to not get caught up in the end result. Is to just be present for that very moment, for that very movement that you're doing. If you need to change the water, if the water's dirty, change the water. You know, if it's disheartening, you know, because what we're there washing the pots to get them clean. So if we're washing the pots in dirty water, then we're not going to be doing as effective a job as if we were in clean water. So is that, yeah, okay.
Uh-huh. Can you say more about how you plan meals? Like the first day you plan a certain, like what?
Uh-huh.
Or with what in mind?
Uh-huh. So at the beginning of the retreat, the very first meal is the evening meal, and it tends to be a hearty soup and salad. Salad just because that's something everybody's familiar with, and a lot of people, at least in California, like salad. Soup is very grounding and centering, and we tend to do a hearty soup so that it helps fill you up, make you feel satisfied. So you have a little bit to go into the retreat in that way. The first lunch that I always cook is just because I started doing it. I created this meal, I don't know when, and I started doing it, and I saw this is a meal I enjoy making no matter how many times I make, and so I just do it. And now, you know, at least the people that come to the retreats where I'm the head cook know that, you know, if they've done it long enough, they know that this is the meal they're going to get the first lunch, you know, which is ginger baked tofu and rice, vegetables, and a sauce. So it's like a basic thing. Teas are light, the evening meals are light, and that's to help you stay alert. In India and other parts of Asia where we practice, tea is, and I haven't been there, but I hear that tea is just a light soup or a broth. Maybe it's one piece of fruit. So here we say, you know, we realize people here are too used to eating, so we just make it a little lighter. And that helps keep you alert for the evening talks and the evening practice. And that's more at the end. Try to, at the end of the retreat, unless there's a lot of leftovers, then you just have to really work with the leftovers. But give a meal that you go back out into the world with. You know, whether it's eggs or pancakes for breakfast meal, or maybe the lunch or the tea before, it might be a Mexican meal or something that you can relate to back out in the world. Yeah.
You've talked a lot about practicing in a skill that you seem to be very skilled in, something you're learning, something new to you.
So yes, this one. I've also worked in situations where I'm a little uncomfortable. I've worked in early recovery houses from drugs and alcohol. with moms and children. Actually, talking with this group here in a number of ways is new for me. I come from a lower class and poverty background, and so talking to people that are more of middle class and upper is difficult, as well as talking in a group is difficult for me. So, in many ways, and I like to do it. I enjoy challenges, so I enjoy newness. I enjoy doing things that. Now, if you're talking about uncomfortable or unfamiliar, uncomfortable,
unfamiliar.
Okay, so that's pretty much, yeah.
But the two are often.
Right.
You mentioned a little earlier, a couple of times actually, about the heart part of your interaction with the working kitchen and other areas too, but. I wondered if you could elaborate on it a little bit, because the work with the food or with whatever you're working with, doing it, or if you're doing it by yourself or you in the broom or whatever, is one phase of it. But like if you're a head cook, you work with other people in the kitchen, and if you're doing that as a practice with particular awareness. About that.
Sure.
It seems like it might be something that could be useful.
Sure, yeah. More and more I'm using that. Some of the cooks that I work with, I've worked with quite a while now, and some are brand new. And so there's different levels depending on their cooking training and depending on their Vipassana training. With some people, you know, and then the yogis also, you know, which actually many of the yogis students come back many times. So I've worked with some students many times, 6, 7, 8 times, different retreats. And sometimes they sign up for the same work practice. And so when I see that happening, what I do is work with them in that particular work practice a little more. If I notice, I'm thinking of one person in particular, noticed that she would always sign up for veggie chopping, and I noticed in her practice there was a certain sense that she needed to work with her aversion. So I had her work with vegetables that would help her get in touch and work with her aversion. You could probably imagine the vegetable I had her work with. Onions. But, you know, I also had her work with other vegetables. But I had her do that as a little bit of each day, you know.
Vegetables help you work with aversion.
Well, it depends on the individual and the person. But a lot of people, it is onions. Because they cry or because the flavor stays on their hands for a long time. Sometimes it's a real hard vegetable, like a carrot or, you know, something that takes a lot of force. Sometimes it's something that's very soft or squishy. You know, everybody's different. So.
What about working with difficult people? In the kitchen or wherever your integrated practice is.
For me, it really depends on where I am, how difficult it is, or if it's really difficult for me. If I'm having a difficult day, and someone else is having a difficult day, it's often difficult. You know, sometimes I just take space apart, you know. If I'm not real clear in myself, then that's mostly what I want to do, you know, because I don't want them to also have to pick up my stuff as well as their own, you know. And sometimes compassion, often compassion.
Really careful and cautious.
Sometimes
in a situation like that.
Sometimes caution and sometimes just compassion. They're different. Yeah.
You you're not close to that person at all.
Oh, well, actually, there's only been one situation that I know of in my experience that has been potentially dangerous, and I let the teacher know that. So they were actually asked to not be in the kitchen for a while until they did a little more work. And so, yeah, I have to take care of myself, and also I'm putting out this meal, or in charge of putting out the meal in a way that is harmonious, hopefully, to the retreat. And so if I'm aware of something that's very disruptive, then I do need to take care with that. Yeah. That's very rare, very rare. It's time. Thank you.